Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast, hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan, and today we have the illustrious Christopher Connor of Connor and Perry Architects. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Appreciate you coming in. So I always like to start with, you know, a little bit of background on, you know, on the principle that's in. So tell me a little bit about how you got started in architecture originally.
Depends on how far back you want to go.
You don't have to go all the way back to the very beginning.
Yeah, but, no, it's fine. You know. I mean, I knew from a pretty early age that I was interested in architecture. I grew up, my dad's a carpenter and a contractor, so I grew up on job sites. You know,
gotcha.
Had a pretty good aptitude for math and science as well as the visual arts when I was a kid, so it all kind of came together and made sense. I actually did some internships while I was in high school and took night classes at the local community college for drafting. So, you know, I had a pretty good idea early on that that's what I wanted to do.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I mean, taking night classes on your own accord, not because you have to, in high school, commendable, absolutely. Well, that's great. So, you know, growing up on construction sites, you know, and I assume you probably work with your dad and obviously him being carpenter and, you know, general contractor, you know, those, you know, kind of hands-on, experiences certainly have shaped, the architect that you've become today, right? Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, outside of just the knowledge base you develop, you know, actually being in there, getting your hands dirty, I have this sense that I think human beings learn through their bodies, through physicality, much more deeply than they do just on a cerebral level. Mm. So to me, I think it's developed a very intuitive sense of what it takes to build something, you know, outside of the specifics of engineering or building science. It's just having that understanding of the guy that's out there lugging the sheet of, you know, plywood or swinging the hammer, like, you know, the body remembers. And so I feel like it's given me that kind of intuitive sense.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Were there any particular components of the building side of things that you kind of gravitated towards? Like, talk a little bit about some of the experiences that you had working with your dad on job sites.
Well, I mean, when I was working with my dad, I was more of a gopher, but, you know, the worst memory is probably roofing in the middle of the summer in Virginia. Mm. It's 100 degrees.
Indeed.
And humid. But, you know, there's certain lessons that you learn that I think are applicable in anything in life. You know, there's measure three times and cut once.
Right.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we kind of did everything from rough framing to more refined woodwork, like cabinetry and trim. And I think I got an appreciation for kind of every stage of building.
You know? That's great. Yeah. So more of a kind of broad overview experience of the whole process.
Yeah.
I was involved in cabinet making when I was a teenager as well. Yeah. I got involved in, construction when I was, I don't know, 15 or so, something like that. And worked a few summers in the construction trade and did, you know, everything from siding to, you know, concrete and, some plumbing and electrical and all that, and ended up discovering cabinetry and found it to be one of the most rewarding, I think, parts of, you know, building a home is taking a stack of, you know, rough sawn lumber and plywood and planing and ripping it into, you know, stiles and rails, right? And boxes and putting those face frames and boxes together and building the doors and drawers. And eventually you've got a set of cabinets.
Yeah.
It's a very rewarding process.
Absolutely.
A lot of respect for folks that do it at a very high level, without doubt. So you and your co-founder, James Perry, both trained under, you know, the kind of, you know, Lautner tradition of organic architecture, you know, early in your careers. How did learning from that legacy influence the way that you approach architecture and design?
Well, I mean, so Lautner was an apprentice of Frank Lloyd Wright, who coined the term organic architecture. And, you know, we, my partner and I, James, worked for a Lautner associate named Duncan Nicholson. That's where we met. And, yeah, it was interesting. Duncan really taught us John's personal kind of take on organic design and the practice of it, which he learned from Frank Lloyd Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting design approach. It's a really personal process. It relies heavily kind of on the power of the individual imagination, while acknowledging that architecture is a collaborative process as well. I mean, Lautner, I like, there's this analogy, kind of a metaphor. They talk about Frank Lloyd Wright's design approach being kind of the musical equivalent of Beethoven. Kind of this idea where you set up a very simple set of rules, and you allow themes to sort of grow out of those simple set of rules. And the analogy for Lautner that I've heard is that he's kind of more equivalent to like Miles Davis or improvisational jazz. Mm. So you establish those rules, you master those rules, you understand them, you allow the design to start growing from them. But you start to understand where to push the rules and bend them and even break them. And I think that kind of frees up the architecture to become more expressive, which is where Lautner really kind of grew and deviated from, you know, Wright's sort of methodology.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Yeah, we've actually got, it's a very small project, but we have a Frank Lloyd Wright design home that we're currently working on.
Oh, cool.
It's a bit of a remodel. It's been really interesting to just spend time in that space, you know, given... you know, his fame and notoriety in the industry, you know, to just walk through the house, I see something different that I didn't notice before. Every time I go there, I find another, there's another aspect of the design that, you know, I kind of look at and, you know, appreciate. So yeah, the very, very influential group of folks.
Yeah.
So yeah, before, you know, before starting the firm, you know, you spent years in New York working in theater planning, you know, acoustics, stuff like that, fabrication. In what ways did those kind of early career experiences end up influencing your approach?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think you can probably tell from the way I talk about musical analogies and things that music was kind of a competing interest of mine growing up. I played cello when I was a kid and piano and guitar. So going into theater design and acoustics was kind of my initial way of trying to bridge those two interests of architecture and performing arts. I think, you know, the biggest thing I took away from that experience, there's two things. One is that an important part of architecture is its ability to sort of enhance our collective experience, bring a sense of sort of drama and delight to things. So that's something that I like to keep in mind when I'm designing. And the other thing is that while architecture is primarily a visual medium, it's so much more than that, you know.
For sure.
That all of your senses really are impacted when you're in a space. And I think that's something critical that you have to keep in mind as well.
Oh, without doubt. You co-founded Connor Perry in 2015. What was your initial you know, approach or I guess vision for the firm, and how has it evolved over time?
Sure. Well, founding the firm was actually kind of a baptism by fire. Our Duncan Nicholson, our former mentor that I mentioned, unfortunately, he passed away rather suddenly from cancer. I mean, it happened in a matter of months. It was really took everyone aback. So we were kind of left in the lurch there, and there were some ongoing projects when he passed away. So that was how the firm got founded. Basically, James and I got together. We were like, well, you know, we got we're gonna do this or we're not. So yeah, so there were a couple of ongoing projects at the time, including you know, the big project at the Sheets Goldstein residence, and also the project in the Rustic Canyon that I mentioned earlier. Yeah, so you know, that's kind of how we got our start. And then we've always kind of imagined this practice. It's kind of an ongoing, evolving experiment. We're trying to figure out what it means to practice that type of organic architecture in the 21st century. You know, we're facing all these sort of technological revolutions. I mean, and at any given time in human history, you know, people were facing technological revolutions.
That's accurate.
But I think right now it's particularly interesting, especially with things like AI kind of questioning what does creativity even mean? Where does it come from? And a practice like ours, where like the power of the individual imagination is kind of central to the whole thing. It's an interesting question, you know, and we don't claim to have the answers, but I think part of our practice is continually investigating what that means and trying to figure out how to weave those kind of technologies into our specific design philosophy. Mm.
How are you using AI today, for example, or are you using AI today in your practice?
A bit. Mostly we're using it to bring efficiency to sort of mundane tasks, mm-hmm. which I think is great.
Absolutely.
I think that is what it would be amazing for moving forward. The thing I have trouble with is there seems to be this tendency for people to cede the creative process over to these generative AI models, which I think is a bit unfortunate. To me, it kind of speaks to a path where the human creative capacity starts to wither and atrophy, which I think would be truly unfortunate. Mm. So we're trying to figure out ways to have it make our practice more efficient, but we're trying to be very conscious of keeping the creative process, you know, with the individual designer.
Indeed. Yeah. Now, your point about atrophy, I think, is 100% spot on. Mm. If we kind of, you know, let the machine do the creative work for us, then what's left?
Yeah. What's the point? Well, what's the point of being
right now?
An architect to me.
Absolutely. And I, back to your point about music, I'm also a musician. Initially got into this business through the music business, and I can't imagine just letting the computer just do it all. It just, that takes all of the fun out of it and the whole purpose out of it. And you know, if you put on like a music channel these days, especially if it's like on YouTube or something where you just kind of, oh yeah, here's some cool graphics and there's some music. Yeah, it's great for the background. I'm cleaning or whatever. You'll find that a lot of it is AI generated music, which is fine, I guess, just for background, but it really got me thinking again about the creative process and, you know, what is creativity, and to, you know, to your point there. So especially in the architecture space, you know, when you're designing spaces for individuals, actual human beings to live, it seems like a real shame to just completely cede that, that, you know, the creative aspect to the entity, whatever the thing is, yeah. You know, the large language model, whatever the thing is. So, yeah, hopefully it can help us to, you know, do more of the mundane stuff and, you know, make us more efficient with yeah. our time and really allow us to focus on the things that really only a human can do mm-hmm. well. So we'll see. I think the jury is still,
yeah,
still out, so to speak there. Right. Yeah.
I mean, I do understand the impulse though, in terms of the people who are creating AIs, you know, it's kind of, it's the ultimate Turing test, right? You know, right. if an AI can actually create original, thoughtful, you know, inspiring art.
Sure.
I mean, sure. Like that's, I understand the impulse, but right. I don't think that it does humanity a great service to seed that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, this gets back to the age old question in the technology business. Anyway, I've found myself asking this question. It's like, oh, that's great. We can do this or that. Why? Mm-hmm. Are we doing it just because we can? That doesn't make any sense necessarily for, you know, our customer, mm. right? We need to respond to what they need, what their lifestyle calls for, and support their lifestyle, not just thrust upon them some technology or some feature set just because we can do it. Mm. And I find myself thinking about this all the time as it relates to AI. Like, why are we doing this again? You know, I don't want to spend a bunch of time doing, you know, laundry and these other kind of tasks. I want to do creative, fun stuff. So we're having the computer do the creative, fun stuff just because we can. It seems wild and crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting experiment, you know. I think it's interesting to push the limits of the technology and see sure. what it can do. But yeah, at the end of the day, I don't think we want to rely on it.
No.
not for creative endeavors anyway.
No, indeed.
But I think the most interesting thing is where it has the potential to be not a generative source, but kind of a creative partner or a sounding board.
Sure.
A collaborator, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like that's where people are pushing the technology.
No.
Even when they talk about it being used in that fashion.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. And you know, another component is assuming that they're programmed in such a way that they are just completely objective, you know, a fact-checking apparatus, mm. right? Look over my plans and make sure they meet all of these codes. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much time do you spend making sure and double-checking and going back and looking at the code book and, okay, all right, yeah, I've got the, you know, required, you know, space around this area or that area for maintenance, or the opening is big enough, or, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That seems like a really good use of, you know, of that resource is to, you know, do the more kind of mundane things and make sure that, all right, yeah, all the boxes are checked. Mm-hmm. We're meeting all the requirements here, right? Because sometimes there can be quite a lot of requirements and details, right?
Yeah,
it's hard
absolutely.
For us to just remember them all,
sure.
Much less get in there and check all those boxes. So switching gears a little bit to your firm. So you guys are one of about 40 firms involved in the Case Study 2.0 efforts, trying to, you know, create a catalog of, you know, fire approved and more or less kind of pre you know, reviewed and approved plans for, you know, for the Palisades. What motivated you initially to take part in the effort, and what does, you know, rebuilding the Palisades mean to you personally as an architect?
Well, we heard about the program through a friend who had been invited to participate, and we immediately reached out to Crest. You know, mm-hmm. we knew we had to be a part of it. It just seems like such a logical response, you know, to this disaster. And also, you know, this idea kind of reaching back to the original case study program from the 50s. To me, it's sort of a brilliant kind of, you know, response or a way of aggregating ideas.
Sure.
To solve, I mean, these thousands of houses that need to be rebuilt. That said, to me personally, I've lived in LA for over 20 years now. I came out here for grad school originally. And the Palisades in Malibu is just like, it's such a huge part of my personal story. I got married on Point Doom in Malibu. Topanga, before I had kids, I used to surf, and Topanga was my spot, and we actually used to surf there with my old mentor, Duncan, sometimes, we dispersed his ashes there in a paddle-out ceremony, like, and even after that, you know, I used to love to go back to Topanga and take my kids over to the Reel Inn for lunch, like, it's really, you know, the whole area is just, it's woven into my experience of LA. So it really means a lot to me personally.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to do whatever we could to try to bring it back with some sense of authenticity, you know.
Yeah, indeed. It is a magical, beautiful place.
Yeah.
It's one of the most kind of epic pieces of real estate in Southern California.
Yeah.
Just geographically, topographically, it's just an amazing place to be. You know, it's a lot of us have, you know, these connections. We've got our favorite places, you know, and my favorite place in Malibu is, you know, over here. And, you know, to your point about, you know, being married in Malibu, you know, that's a very, you know, important milestone in your life, right? So yeah, it's a monumental effort, right? That we're, you know, all faced with, the amount of time that, you know, that it might take to get it back to some semblance of what it was before, you know, could be a decade, right? You know, there's some concern, I think. I've read a story or two about, you know, some venture capital folks coming in and kind of buying up a lot of lots and then maybe kind of controlling what those areas look like with regard to, you know, when they're rebuilt. Are they just rebuilding homes on those lots and flipping them, or, you know, what's going to happen? I think generally everyone involved with the case study program is very much focused on trying to put the place back as much as like as it was in the past as possible, right? Without remaking it into some completely different, you know, neighborhood. I think everyone respects the look and feel and soul of the community and wants to put it back that way as much as possible. So your firm's developed two prototype home designs, for case study two, the California Ranch and, Quonset two story. Talk a little bit about the design elements there and, you know, what are some of the next steps that, you know, a homeowner could, you know, who may be interested in one of those designs, how can they find your designs and work with you on a project?
Sure. Well, you can access all of the designs in the case study program at their website. I think it's casestudy2.0.com or case study two.
Case study two.
Case study 2.com.
Yeah. Make sure and put that in the comment section.
So yeah, there you can see all the architects that are participating in all their designs. And if there's one that you're interested in, you can download a PDF package with kind of schematic design with renderings and floor plans. Our specific response, with the two designs that we did, there were two kind of main concerns that they both have in common. One is speed of construction. They both kind of have prefabricated steel elements, so that, you know, readily available fireproof material.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is that each one has this sense of being adaptable. You know, the ranch project is based on a Usonian sort of principle that was developed by Frank Lloyd Wright, where the design is laid out on a grid, and that grid is sort of adaptable and modular, and it can kind of grow or shrink, and the floor plan can change, but it's based on this modular set of structural frames, and they're moment frames. So you get a free span underneath of them, and it kind of allows, so you know, the floor plan that you're seeing in the package is a specific design for a specific site, but the idea is that it's adaptable to almost any site in LA. And then also the skin system that gets put on that is also a prefabricated insulated steel panel system. Mm-hmm. And there's a variety of ways that that can be modular. It can be shaped or attached different colors. It allows you sort of a little bit of individual expression. Mm-hmm. And the Quonset is very similar in that way. So it's also a modular system. It can kind of grow or shrink. You can change the radius of the arc to suit the site. You know, and the one that we developed for the program is very specific to a 6,500 square foot site, you know, in the Alphabet Streets. But again, very adaptable. The Quonset system creates a free span, again, open space. So you can almost do anything you want underneath of that that shell that it creates. Mm. But I think the unique aspect of that design, the thing that makes it really a vehicle for individual expression, is that it has this feature wall that kind of cuts through the shape. And in the catalog, we're showing it finished in kind of an orange field tile. But you can finish it basically in any fire-resilient material that you want. You know, you could do stucco, you could do different tiles, you could do concrete, you could do really anything. I like to imagine it almost you could do like a custom mosaic, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the possibilities are really endless. But that's kind of our main goal, was to make something that could be built quickly, that has a unique kind of dynamic form and doesn't have this sort of generic developer feel. Mm-hmm. But also each design is very careful to kind of consider landscape and how the building connects you to nature, and making sure that those landscapes are fire resilient as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. I have to go and look. That I haven't seen these designs. Mm. The Quonset two story. I'm really interested in, because anytime you've got arcs, domes, for example, also kind of fall into this category. Mm. Where they're naturally wind resistant. Mm-hmm. And very strong structures. Like from a structural perspective, you know, just by nature, they're very that's the word I'm looking for. They're just structurally, you know, there isn't a lot of complexity. Yeah. Really there. And specifically as it relates to wind, you know, the more the wind blows on a dome, the more it pushes it down. Yeah. To the ground. Yeah. You know, and oddly enough, domes, geodesic domes are really not taken off still. Mm-hmm. I've got a family member that built a dome, and he was able to get it approved basically just by saying, oh yeah, there's a, you know, 1500 square foot, whatever house on this lot that I'm building. He didn't even say it was a dome. Yeah. But there's still a lot of pushback from, you know, the building departments. Mm-hmm. On these kind of non-standard structures, right? Mm-hmm. If it's something that they haven't seen or they haven't dealt with a lot, it's whoa, you know, you kind of, oh no, we don't want to do that. You know, it's non-standard, you know, but there's a lot of really great benefits to, you know, these types of,
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the arch is one of the most efficient
absolutely
structural shapes that there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
that was kind of my initial interest in it, was just the efficiency of it, but also the beauty of it, you know?
Sure.
That it wasn't just kind of a standard box.
Right.
And
there's plenty of those out there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And you know, you can design a beautiful, immaculately detailed box. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and that's something that we take inspiration from Lautner's work as well, is that he described his architecture as anti-box, which, you know, in mid-century architecture, modern architecture was kind of a radical idea. Right?
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, James and I talk about trying to escape kind of this oppressive regime of the flat white ceiling. That to us, more than anything else in architecture these days, is something that makes a house feel kind of, even when you have 14-foot high ceilings, it makes it feel kind of oppressive and overwhelming. And the idea that the ceiling that's above you has some form or drama or shape to it, it allows the people that inhabit those spaces to feel a bit more free or invigorated, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some shadows even, right? When you have arches, you've got the opportunity for uplighting in a way that you wouldn't have with a flat ceiling. And, you know, there's a lot of other opportunity there for sure. Yeah. I like your point about drama, in the space, because the ceilings, you know, yeah, there's a lot of flat white ceilings out there, and it looks like they're becoming more and more sacred, also to the extent that we're trying to get the kind of busy nature of those flat white ceilings simplified, right, by removing devices or otherwise making them invisible, hiding them as much as possible. So, yeah, just kind of discarding that completely for something new and different. It's an awesome approach. Super cool. So a fellow architect in the initiative kind of, you know, said the goal after a wildfire is not only to rebuild homes, but, you know, to restore hope, right? In your experience, how can, you know, architecture help heal a community and, you know, bring back a sense of hope in the Palisades specifically?
Well, I'll say we were up at the Alphabet Streets with a client a few weeks ago, and just seeing those first few houses being framed, I mean, it almost brought tears to the client's eyes.
Sure.
I mean, it's sure. At this point when there's nothing there, it's not just like an act of necessity. It's an act of bravery almost, you know?
Right.
That said, you know, I think there's this tendency in our profession to act like architecture can save the world, which it's an important part of it. But at the end of the day, you know, the thing that makes a community like that is the people and the institutions. And I feel like architecture, as important as it is providing sort of the framework for those things to thrive. Right. That said, I think it's also incredibly important that architecture can be inspiring, you know, and should be, even something as simple as someone's home, you know, like I was talking about previously, should kind of provide this sense of kind of delight, and inspire, you know, an individual in their daily routine.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, with this client that I was talking about, the thing that struck me the most, because, you know, part of our design process is getting to know our clients just as much as it is getting to know the site and talking to them. You know, we always talk about, you know, your daily routine and what you're used to versus like what your ideal version of that is. Mm-hmm. And I'm just talking to them, and they were talking about just that morning routine of like not even having to get into your car and just walk your kids down the street to the elementary school. And, you know, this, just this strong sense of kind of place, outside of the house or the architecture or whatever it is, to me, that was kind of the most important thing that I think we need to try to bring back. And architecture has a huge role in that, no sure. doubt. But I think it's important to keep our eyes on that, right? And not so much what these individual formal solutions are, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, that's a great point. We've talked a lot in prior episodes about specific types of architecture, right? The Spanish style, the modern, the Cape Cod, the, you know, et cetera. And I would tend to agree with you that the larger context of the community and, you know, to your point, the ability to just walk your kids to school because there's a, you know, there's a school close by, right? You know, and the other kind of more high level components of the community are arguably more important, right, than the individual style of, you know, the homes. Yeah, it's complicated, and everyone has a different view and thought, you know, about how we're going to get there.
Yeah.
So as far as like lessons from, you know, this process of, you know, rebuilding, you know, what lessons do you think should really, you know, let's see, let me start this over. Let me just read this out and see if this makes sense. Because now that I'm reading it out loud, it doesn't make as much sense to me as it did initially.
Okay.
What lessons from rebuilding the Palisades do you think should guide how Los Angeles designs and builds its communities in the future?
Mm. Well, I mean, to me, the most interesting and sort of promising aspect of all this is actually the response that we've gotten from regulatory agencies,
mm-hmm.
And the sense of urgency to rebuild housing and going out of their way to sort of like figure out which codes are necessary to developing healthy, safe communities and which ones have become kind of onerous. And I think if our partners in government can take that sense of urgency and that attitude and bring that forward to address the housing crisis that we have in California in general, I think that would be a huge step forward. Because I do feel like it's become onerous, you know, over the past few decades to just build housing, which we desperately need. So I think lesson learned there. Yeah, absolutely. If we can carry that sense of urgency beyond just rebuilding these neighborhoods, I think that'll make the state a better place to live. To be honest.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I absolutely agree. I think the jury's still out on that one.
yeah. We're still going through it, you know.
Yeah, but without doubt. We'll circle back, you know, to the conversation once there's more activity,
absolutely.
I think, in the community, and there's, you know, more folks have gone through the process. We've got several projects that basically obviously stopped, you know, in January, and some of those are starting back up again finally, which is good news. Homeowners are reaching out and letting us know, okay, we're going to get construction going again. We even had a project that was nearly done. We were really at the final stages, and you know, the homeowners have had, you know, immense inconvenience and disruption to their lives to the extent that now they're, you know, in some temporary housing situation that they didn't expect to be in at unexpected expense, et cetera.
Sure.
And even once the home is completed, you know, it's not in the same neighborhood that it was, so to speak, right, that it was before, right? The rest of the neighborhood is gone. While the home was spared, which, again, we've talked a lot about, you know, resiliency and resistance to fire and materials and all this stuff at length on the podcast. And one of the themes that I think maybe hasn't gotten as much attention is fire behavior. Mm. You probably get a degree in fire behavior, yeah. Right? I would imagine. But fire experts would probably tell you that, their fire does wild and unpredictable things. And this one specific residence that I was just referring to is on a street where almost everything else is gone. Mm-hmm. And there were houses behind, to the left, and to the right of this particular home that are all completely gone. Yet this residence, practically untouched. Yeah. I think there was a little bit of damage, maybe on like the back kind of guest house door or something like that. Raging fires on both sides. The only way I personally, not being an expert, of course, in materials or fire behavior, the only way that I can really explain how that home and many others that had one, an adjacent home completely destroyed, is fire behavior. Mm-hmm. I can't think of another way to explain it, given the materials are all basically the same in the area. It's not like one home was built completely out of concrete, for example, and the right. one next to it was cedar shake. You know, they're all pretty similar. Mm. And this one's still there untouched. So yeah,
there's quite a few instances of that. Yeah. If you look at the satellite map, right? I mean, it's
wild.
Inexplicable.
It is inexplicable. No, all great points. It's been a great conversation. It's been great to catch up with you and and have the conversation. Is there any kind of plug that you want to make for your firm, for case study, any other organization that might be out there trying to help folks? Any other resources or directions you might want to direct anyone that may need any of these services?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you'd like to check out our work, we're at connor-perry.com. The Case Study 2.0 website is a great resource. Again, I think that's casestudy2.com. I know the AIA LA is putting together, or is it AIA California? One of those. They're putting together a searchable database of architects that are participating and actively engaging with communities about helping to rebuild. So I would look at those two organizations as well.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Great. Any other closing thoughts?
No, I think it's just, it's time to get to work, I think.
Yes, it is.
I think the only way that we're going to rebuild these neighborhoods with any sense of authenticity is just to do what we do, to engage with clients and help them build homes that are expressions of themselves. Like that's how communities organically form like this.
Yeah, indeed.
As much as we want to rebuild quickly, and I think we'll do our best to, I think if we want neighborhoods that have a real sense of authenticity, we just got to do the work. We got to go through it.
Yeah. Well, I think the one thing that the community has going for it, and LA and Southern California generally, is there's a very diverse pool of very sophisticated and talented design build professionals.
Absolutely.
That are ready to get after it. And I think just given that large pool of sophisticated stakeholders and diverse stakeholders with varying, differing opinions on things, that we're going to get, a new community built that's reflective of the people that live there, and that is diverse from a design perspective and from a cultural perspective. And it's going to look and be awesome. It's just going to take a while to get there. So, Chris, thank you again for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Participating. Absolutely. And we look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you.